A beloved public figure here on the First Coast throws her hat into the political ring. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, a conversation with Donna Deegan as she files to run for Congress and challenge John Rutherford for his seat in Washington. You can join us right now. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, our new contributor, Matt Pittman, joins the show with some ideas to take you all around town this weekend. That's later on. But first this morning, she's a Jacksonville native, a public figure, and an activist. Former news anchor Donna Deegan is also well known as a breast cancer survivor and the founder of the globally recognized 26.2 with Donna Marathon. Now, Deegan is opening up a brand new chapter. She's running for office, filing to challenge Congressman John Rutherford for his seat in Congress. Donna Deegan joins us now with more about her campaign and why she decided to enter the world of politics. Donna Deegan, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Good to be with you.
Always good to have you on the show. Today is certainly a very newsworthy day for this community, and we want your calls. What are your questions and comments for now, candidate Donna Deegan? It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and tweets to @MelissaInJax. Lots of comments on our Facebook page already. We'll get to those in a few minutes. Okay, why'd you decide to enter this race?
Well, Melissa, you know, I've been very involved for 16 years now since I was diagnosed with cancer. I was diagnosed with cancer 20 years ago this month, actually. So I'm a 20-year cancer survivor as of this month. And that really changed everything about my life. I had this trajectory of my life that I had in mind. I thought I'd be anchoring the news here in Jacksonville forever and ever. As you know, I'm a Jacksonville native. And when I got the opportunity to come back here and do that, I thought, wow, this is my dream and this is my life. And then cancer changed a lot of things. You know, when you have those well thought out plans for life, God tends to throw you a little curveball and say, hey, you know, something else for you to do. And so when I started the foundation back in 2003, I started hearing from women all over the place who were having to choose between putting food on the table for their kids and saving their lives. I have heard those stories now for 16 years. They haven't gotten any better. It's gotten more dire for people. And so as I went along in that process, I became more and more frustrated with the fact that still here we are. We are still denying healthcare to a lot of people. There are still so many people struggling. There is a solution to this. We have to get people covered. And I would say that the two things that launched me into this were, number one, I do not want my children becoming adults in a world in where they think our current political discourse is in any way, shape, or form acceptable. Not acceptable. And then we must provide universal health care for everyone. That should be a human right, period, end of story. And I don't care how we get there. I'm not married to a particular plan, but it is absolutely morally reprehensible that we do not offer people health care. And that's the main reason I'm in this race.
You're running as a Democrat,
yes,
challenging a well-known and well-financed Republican in a heavily conservative district.
What could go wrong?
How will you sell this message of universal health care and other issues to voters in the district who have elected John Rutherford by a comfortable margin?
Well, I think that my footprint in this community from all of my years of being on television. And let's remember, I spent the huge majority of my time as an adult, as an NPA. I became a Democrat to become involved in the last election. But the truth is, I have spent my entire career listening to everyone. I truly believed that there were voices on both sides that would help come to solutions on things. I truly believed in that process. And I think it's only been recently that I feel like it's just the loud shouting voices that are the ones that are getting all the attention. And I will say off the bat, I have nothing personal against John Rutherford. Our positions are simply different. I don't believe we should take away health care from millions of people. I believe that we need to expand health care. And frankly, if you look at the polls, Melissa, even in this district, if you look at the polls of how people feel about health care, It is one of the very top issues, if not the top issue, to everyone. They want access to that. So I think that people tend to vote their party because that's where we are right now. We're in a very polarized place. But what I'm hoping is that people realize I am a person who is used to listening. I want to listen. I will spend the next year listening, and I will represent their voices in the House of Representatives if they'll allow me to. So I don't think that we are in a time right now where we can just say, let's entrench into our parties. We've got to start talking to each other. And I think if you look at how most Americans feel about healthcare, they like the idea of everyone being covered.
Do you support Medicare for all?
Well, I think Medicare for all is an interesting discussion. But honestly, I think at this point, I think if you look at how most people are feeling in this country, when you look at the polling, it's not that they're negative against Medicare for all. It's just I think there is a great deal of fear about people losing their current insurance. So I think the better plan right now, and like I said, I'm open to any of them. I think the better plan would be to find a way to expand the coverage that we have right now, to include the insurance companies, the private insurance companies that we have right now.
So you are a more moderate Democrat than it sounds like on health care than some of the presidential candidates leading the field right now. Elizabeth Warren comes to mind. She's taking out a much more progressive position on this issue.
Well, let me just say this, okay? I'm a little disheartened by the food fight that is happening over how we handle health care. I think that Medicare for all is worth a discussion. I think they're all worth a discussion. We could look at a plan like Germany has, where, again, the private insurance companies are brought into the equation. There are so many ways to deal with it. But here's the line I want to draw. Republicans in Congress right now, for all of my Republican friends out there, you should know that they are trying right now through lawsuits to take away your coverage for pre-existing conditions. People want their coverage for pre-existing conditions to stay. They are trying to put a cap on what people can spend lifetime or coverage they can get lifetime. People don't want that by and large. They want their children to be able to stay on their policies until they're 26 years old. Those are all very popular across the spectrum of Democrats, Republicans, and no party affiliates. So what's happening is we have a Congress that has been intransigent on some of these issues and in some cases voted against that instead of doing what the people are saying they want.
Women in particular across this country, I think it's an understatement to say, are angry about this issue of healthcare and other issues.
Yep.
Many of them are channeling that anger into running for public office as you are. Some have won, some have lost. At the same time, I want to follow up with you about the partisan nature of this district. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to draw an example from our recent past. Back in 2010, another former news anchor like you, Deborah Giannoulis, ran for office. She ran against John Thrasher for a state Senate seat in our area. Mm-hmm. Now, other than you, there is perhaps no other female public figure in this area that was more well-known and more beloved than Deborah Giannoulis. Still, she lost in a landslide to John Thrasher in that race because it was a heavily Republican district. Your district that you're running in, District 4, encompasses Duval, Nassau, and St. John's. The Duval County section of the district is gerrymandered to favor Republicans in particular. Mm-hmm. How do you plan to deal with this dynamic in the race?
Well, obviously, it's disconcerting that we have gerrymandered districts, right? But I think that goes back to being willing to talk to everybody. I love Deborah. I think she's one of the most fantastic people out there on the planet. And I talked with her before I decided to do this. I think it's too bad that people are painted in ways, and she was, in ways that are not accurate. You know, right now, if you're a Democrat, you're painted as a socialist. Let me just put it out there right now. I'm a capitalist. I believe in capitalism, and anybody that says anything otherwise is not telling the truth about me. So I will be holding people accountable for the things they say. You know I am not afraid to speak truth to power, but I always think that listening is the most important thing. You said something the other day that stuck with me, that first seek to understand and then to be understood. And I think that's what I will go at this with. I want to understand where people are coming from. I understand that we're not going to agree on everything. But know that I will listen and I will represent the people of this district. But I'll say this too, Melissa. Duval is in a different place, and so is the entire district, than when Deborah ran back in 2010. We've seen Duval move 5%, 5 points more blue from 2016 to 2018. We've seen in this district, 40% now college educated, majority women. We've seen a lot more diversity in this district than we had the last time that we had an election. And that's just continuing. A lot of new neighborhoods of young families that think differently about some of these things. So at the end of the day, you know, don't let anybody think that I didn't know the numbers when I came in. Okay, I realize this is a climb. Clearly, I'm used to those. I've had tougher climbs. So that part of it doesn't scare me. For me, it is about service. And somebody has to step in to try to change the narrative that we have going on in this country, or we're going to lose our democracy if we continue to be so ugly to each other.
Are you referring to President Trump?
You know, I don't like the way he talks to people. I'll be honest. I think that the way that he speaks is counterproductive much of the time. It is chaotic. I think he brings out some of our worst angels sometimes. And I understand that there are some things about this president that people appreciate. They say that he speaks his mind. But I think, unfortunately, when you look at the national discourse right now, the way he has handled himself has not led us to more unity. It's led us to more division. And I think we have got to let go of the politics of fear and start coming together as a country, as patriots, as people who love America, and stop painting each other as the enemy.
Your opponent, John Rutherford, is a strong supporter of the president. He took some incoming flack for being in the minority of Republicans who didn't support a resolution essentially rebuking President Trump for his actions in Syria. Mm-hmm. Still, though, the majority of constituents in his district seem to like his close tie to the president. So how do you convince them that Trump is wrong and that Rutherford is wrong?
Again, I will listen to everybody, anybody and everybody on this issue. But I will say, in speaking to our local military community, they were not particularly happy with that vote. I don't believe that tying yourself in lockstep to anyone is the way to represent your community. And I won't do that. If people send me to Congress, I will not have one vote that is based on whether I will be reelected or who may be upset with me. I'm going to Congress if I go, and hopefully I go, to represent people in this community. And I think people know my heart. They know where I'm coming from. They know I love this community, and they know I'll listen. So I hear what you're saying, but I do think that we need to have that conversation.
Lots of calls, meanwhile, for Donna Deegan, now a candidate for Congress. Deegan will challenge Republican incumbent John Rutherford in next year's election. There are a few other candidates who filed, but these will be the two most high-profile names in the race. This is for District 4 here in our area. What are your questions? 549-2937. Shannon is in Atlantic Beach. Hi, Shannon.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning, Shannon.
Listen, Donna, I broke out on this huge grin yesterday when I heard about this. And I am so excited, and I am 100% in if you need my help.
Thank you so much.
That's all I got to say.
I appreciate you very much. Thank you. One of my neighbors in Atlantic Beach, I'm guessing.
All right. And we're here. And by the way, we have calls from across the listening area. Adam is in Ponte Vedra Beach. Hey, Adam. Good morning.
Good morning. I am one of Representative Rutherford's constituents. And politics and policies aside, you don't see him in the community. He doesn't really hold town halls. He's just not around. If Donna Deegan is elected, will you commit to holding regular town halls, to listening to the constituents in the district, to hearing people and having conversations with everyone?
Adam, thanks for that. You know, I asked both Congressman Rutherford and Congressman Al Lawson about this issue when they appeared here on this program during the August recess earlier this summer. Both of them have been criticized over this. Here is Rutherford explaining to me back in August why he is not holding town halls. Why not?
Because they're dysfunctional. My responsibility to my constituents is to make myself available. And I do that every day, day in and day out. Anybody can come to my office, and they do. I speak at every civic group in this district from Nassau to St. John's County.
Rutherford's refusal to hold town halls has upset some constituents. Al Lawson, as well, has taken criticism. Would you hold town halls if you're elected to Congress?
Oh, my gosh. Absolutely. I'll hold town halls now. I'll hold town halls for the next year. Actually, Melissa, I was listening when Representative Rutherford said that on your show. And I will be honest with you to say that at that point, I was still on the fence as to whether or not I was going to take this plunge. And it was one of the things that really put me over the top. And I thought, you know, that's our job. As a representative for a district, our jobs are to take that incoming, are to take the people even that we don't agree with and that we think may be unreasonable or unfair to us. And I get that. It's uncomfortable and it's no fun, but it's part of the job. And so absolutely, to your caller, I will be out there speaking to as many groups as I can on all sides of the aisle, mostly listening to you, but also trying to share where I'm coming from. And truly, I am here to try to break through this crazy environment, this noise that we have going on right now that seems to only reward the people who shout the loudest. I think we've got to listen to each other, or there will be no long-term solutions to anything. If we are simply going to race to one side or the other and never let the other side have a compromise or a win, we will never have sustained progress in this country.
You campaigned for Andrew Gillum. He lost in a whisker to Governor Ron DeSantis. How will you take this message of moderation to potential constituents out there who don't like the fact that you campaigned for Gillum, a strong progressive?
Listen, Andrew Gillum is a dear friend, and I admire him so much. He taught me so much about the work ethic that is involved in doing something like this, and I admire his authenticity, and I admire so many things about him. I would never shy away from Andrew Gillum or my support for him. That would make me a pretty awful person if I did that for political expediency. But at the end of the day, what I want people to understand is that this is a race about Jacksonville. This is a race about this district and this constituency. And I think that authenticity is incredibly important. And I think that listening is incredibly important. And I've always felt that way. And honestly, I believe that Andrew Gillum felt that way. I believe that it's very easy to get painted in certain ways when you get into these races. And you and I talked about this. I think there were all sorts of falsehoods thrown around during that race. And frankly, it's part of our politics now, which is reprehensible and shouldn't happen.
And how will you deal with the Rutherford campaign employing those kinds of tactics upon you as a candidate? This is how candidates roll and how campaigns operate today.
Well, it shouldn't be. And I'll tell you that it is very disconcerting to me. I said this to you before when we were in the middle of the other campaign. I was actually, it's hard to surprise me. You know, I'm not new on the scene, but I was actually surprised by the level of that mentality of the end justifies the means, that all is fair in war, and that power is all that matters. I will not conduct myself in that way in this campaign. It would be against who I am. It will be against my brand as a human. I don't believe that fear will get us anywhere for the long haul, and I won't employ those tactics. Can I do anything about what they say? No, I can't. But what I will do is I will not play in that ball field.
Let's go to Linnell in Mandarin. Linnell, good morning. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. First off, I'm a 27-and-a-half-year veteran of the United States Navy. I'm a lifelong Democrat.
Thank you for your service.
Thank you very much. My wife is a 22-year veteran of the United States Navy and is a lifelong Republican. So I can appreciate you talking about listening to us.
Yes.
Because we are more complex than political identities. We are a member of the LGBTQ community. We are gun owners. We believe in the Department of Veteran Affairs. We don't feel represented by John Rutherford, neither Republican or Democrat in our home. We do not feel represented by him. We believe in common sense gun legislation. He seems to be extreme right and isn't listening to the people, especially about universal background checks. He seems to want to politicize the VA and use it as a cash cow here locally. We get great care from the Department of Veteran Affairs. We're looking for someone to support the VA and make sure they get the funding that they need, but also the accountability at the Department of Veteran Affairs. But we really are more complex than two political identities in our home. So we appreciate the fact that you've always listened to people, whether you were on the air or in your organization, providing care for people in our community, regardless of their socioeconomic situation or their religion or their political party affiliation. And we're really looking forward to coming out and listening to you, ma'am, and see what you have to offer our community.
Thank you so much for that. That is exactly where I think the conversations at most kitchen tables are, Melissa. If you look at social media, you would get the idea that everyone hates everyone. And I just don't believe that's true. I think more families are like this family, where there's so much. I know nuance doesn't sell. I've heard it over and over again. You've got to be, you've got to have specific. Look, I get that. But people have households where these discussions are happening, and they want somebody who's actually listening and not simply walking in lockstep with some ideology that they do not identify with.
What about her comment on guns? We're getting more calls from folks wanting to know your stance on gun reform.
Well, listen, in a Fox News poll that came out last year, 91% of Americans said they want background checks on all gun buyers, including private sellers. 91%, Melissa. This is a Fox News poll. This is not a partisan issue. Both Democrats and Republicans, NPAs, everybody can see this is what we've lost in our government. The ability to use common sense. It's common sense that we should have universal background checks. People want them. They should be delivered. And frankly, the NRA should have absolutely no role in making policy. public policy in any way, shape, or form.
Would you go farther? Would you support an assault weapons ban? Would you support red flag laws, which prevent those with a history of violence or mental illness from immediately quickly getting a weapon?
Well, let me go further on that Fox News poll that I was telling you about, okay? 84% of all gun buyers want to have mental health checks. 72% want to raise the age of gun buying to 21. 60% support a ban on assault rifles. But the interesting thing is, do you remember when we had a ban on assault rifles? President Reagan and President Bush won were the ones that put that ban into place. So again, this is not a Democratic issue or a Republican issue. I believe in the Second Amendment. Let me get that out there right now. I believe in people's rights to own guns and to protect their families. The NRA used to be an organization that really supported hunters and land conservation. And now it's just become this political craziness that has failed to listen to the majority of people. So I think those are things that are absolutely worth discussing.
So you'd support an assault weapons ban, which is that may or may not be on the ballot here in Florida next year, that ballot amendment issue.
I think it makes sense. And I think it makes sense to limit the amount of firepower people can
limit
have against each other.
Limit high-capacity magazines.
People are dying all over our country. Thousands of people are dying every day, both at their own hand and at the hand of others. And this is an epidemic that is unique to this country. And we have got to address it. I do not want to go door to door to take away people's guns. Let me say that. That is not something I would support, okay? But I do think there are some common sense things that we can do that everybody, or at least the polling would suggest, I won't say everybody, that the majority of Americans, even in this district, would support. So my number one thing, Melissa, will be background checks. That is the thing I know that we should do and can do. And it's really, it's amazing to me, truly, that we haven't gotten that done. The rest of it, to me, is a conversation we should have.
We are getting so many emails, calls, and tweets for Donna Deegan. Here are just a few comments on Facebook. Scott Saunders writes, I can't support her because she campaigned for Andrew Gillum. Here is another Facebook comment. Why not? Go Donna, says Lynn. And on Twitter, Mitchell tweets, where can we find more information about her stance on the issues? Do you have a website up yet?
I do have a website. We are in the process of building out all of my positions on things. I'm more than happy to go and talk with Mitchell or anybody else who wants to ask me about what I think, but I'm in the process of building
that
out.
So it's not live yet?
The position papers aren't live yet. But
what's the URL?
But the website, it's DonnaDeeganForCongress.com.
Okay. Brian is in San Marco. Hi, Brian. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Melissa. Good morning, Donna. How y'all doing?
Good morning, Brian.
Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate the fact that you are looking at the healthcare issue. So I guess I wanted to, and that you said you support capitalism, because I worked in manufacturing for years, and with healthcare, you can have three things you can aim for. You can have two out of three. You can have universality, affordability, and quality. So I want to know your stance, knowing those three things. You can have quality healthcare that's universal. It won't be affordable. You can have affordable healthcare that's universal. It will not be quality. So those are the three things you have, and this is reality with capitalism. So I want to know what your stance is, knowing those three items. What are the things that would be most important to you? Because that's truly the basket you get with if you want to have quality and affordability, it's not going to be universal, and you're going to have to rely on a safety net of communities and churches and what I think family members should pick up the slack and not the government, in my point of view, because the government does not do good at taking care of people that need help. The community does, and churches and faith-based organizations. So I'll
okay, Brian. I get you. Donna.
Well, Brian, first of all, thank you very much for your comments, and I appreciate your point of view. What I would say to that is I think it's a false choice to say that we cannot have universal health care that we can afford. I believe that we can do that, and I think we can do that and cut costs for families. I think what we cannot afford is what we have right now, which is an unsustainable system. I mean, if you look at the studies of what we're going to spend as Americans on health care over the next 10 years, we're talking about anywhere from $32 trillion to $50 trillion that we're spending. We have people still getting their health care from emergency rooms. So my feeling, Melissa, is, and Brian, is that if dozens of industrialized countries can figure out a way to make sure that everyone has universal coverage, and listen, there are a lot of people in those places very happy with their coverage.
That is true. That said, lots of voters out there like Brian believe that you, as he pointed out, if you have universal coverage, it may not be high quality.
Well,
what do you think about that?
I think there's nothing to indicate that. And if you look at the polling on what the most popular healthcare plans are right now, they are Medicare and TRICARE. They get extremely high marks, both government programs. That's not socialism, by the way. That's a social program. That is not socialism. So I think that is a fear tactic and a scare tactic that people will use to try to pit people against each other on this issue. But the fact is, many people would not want their Social Security or their Medicaid taken away. And when you look at the most popular plans, Medicare is right there. I will say one other thing about what Brian said, because I think this is important. Obviously, I've been somebody for the past 16 years who has been one of those organizations that is trying its best to put its finger in the dike of all this, massive flood of financial toxicity for people. There will never be, as wonderful as they are, there will never be enough church organizations, charity organizations, other organizations of that nature to fully make sure that people have what they need in terms of their health care unless we change our system. So I reject that narrative as something that we cannot do. I believe we can and we must do it, because otherwise, economically, we cannot support where we are.
Here's a tweet for you. What is your position on the Trump GOP tax overhaul bill? Would you have voted for or against that? The tax cuts that Congress and the president enacted early in his term.
Well, I would have clearly voted against that. I think that tax cut largely benefited the elite of the elite. I don't think that most Americans benefited tremendously from that. I think it put the economy on a short-term sugar high, but we're starting to see the effects of that now, where we're starting to look at the jobs numbers for the last 7 months, and those have actually slowed quite significantly from where they were last year. So I think that at the end of the day, what we need to look at is, what are we really doing as far as our tax system is concerned? Do we want to give our tax cuts to the top 1% that now put us $1 trillion in deficit? I mean, I would ask my GOP friends, is that what you mean when you talk about fiscal responsibility? That we now have $1 trillion on our children's credit cards that they are going to have to pay for. If we care about the future of our children, that's not where we want to go. What I would say is, you know, if you look at where we are right now, and I am very pro-business. I do not want to tax businesses into oblivion, okay? But 60 of our largest corporations pay zero in taxes on $79 billion in profit. That's not revenue, Melissa. That's profit. Is that in any way something that makes sense? I mean, there's got to be some sanity and some reason in some of this.
Lots of calls. If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Donna Deegan. She filed paperwork yesterday and is running for Congress, challenging incumbent GOP Representative John Rutherford. This is District 4. A lot of you out there live in the district. It encompasses parts of Duval, St. John's, and Nassau counties. Lots of tweets coming into the show, Facebook comments. Here's one from Julie. No one ever talks about the return on investment for expanding healthcare. It's what business people call a force multiplier. Think in terms of human productivity.
That's right.
Okay, let's go to Bill in Nocatee. Hi, Bill. Good morning.
Morning, Bill.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Donna, you got my vote. I just wanted to say that my big thing, and I've called in on the show several times about this, is I understand that K Street runs Washington. That's a fact. That's the reason you can't get gun legislation, insurance, or health care, anything done, is because big money runs the federal government. I mean, that's just an absolute fact. The same thing in the state house and even locally. So I'd like to know, Donna, what you would do, what legislation you could put in place to restrict lobbying so you could legislate for the people and not for these gigantic corporations.
Well, thanks for your question, Bill.
Yeah, thank you, Bill, so much. I appreciate that. I could not agree with you more. I think it is what frustrates the majority of Americans, you know, more than almost anything else, is that it seems like, and you can understand why people are disaffected, why they tune out, because they feel like there is nobody out there that's actually their voice, but they're the voice of the special interests or the lobbying groups, or they go to Washington perhaps with seemingly good intentions, but end up being owned by these organizations. And I'll say this, I think it's part of the problem, Melissa, is the fact that we don't have term limits. I agree with Tilly Fowler on this one. I think we need term limits. We have people that are
former
going and
Congresswoman who yes. served a certain amount and then pledged not to run again.
She, you know, people go and they park themselves in Washington, and then the objective simply becomes to raise enough money and to do whatever they can to get reelected.
And let me jump in and point out that your opponent, John Rutherford, has $443,000 cash on hand to run for reelection.
And where does that money come from?
Most of that has come from PACs, big money groups. And sadly, the reality is for anyone running for office, money is the key to everything. What's your fundraising strategy? How are you going to compete with Rutherford's powerhouse war chest?
Well, I think we are going to prove that the power of the people is stronger than the people in power. I think that's what we're going to show. We're going to put people over politics with this campaign, and we're going to take donations from anyone and everyone out there in the community who wants to support us. I think there are a lot of people frustrated with this. Look, I don't like the system. I think we all have to play by the rules that are in place, but at the end of the day, if it were me and I were creating legislation, I would certainly push legislation to make elections public, where there wasn't so much big money and I think Citizens United needs to go, and I think that we need to get the big money out of politics. It's not fair.
Here's an email from Terry. I'm a Republican mother of three. I'm a moderate who cares most about decency, values, and the federal deficit. I am on Donna's team. You've been in leadership positions most of your life, Donna. How will you operate as a junior member of Congress and across committees?
You know, that is an interesting question. I have had a lot of people ask me about that. You know, obviously, I don't have any experience in this particular avenue. This is the first time that I've stepped in, and I don't know a lot about how all of that works. In a way, I think that works in my favor. I will literally go up there and be the strongest voice for the people of this district that I can be. And I think that you have to work through those relationships, but I have a lot of confidence in my ability to do that. I've been doing that my whole life. I love this community, and I feel like I am good at building relationships, and I feel like I'm good at listening. So hopefully I can take that to Congress, and I'll be able to work my way into some of those positions.
It's going to be a very interesting race, and we thank you so much for stopping by Studio 5 first to share the details of your new campaign. Donna Deegan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Melissa.
Much more still to come. Up next, celebrating Jacksonville authors at Jacks by Jacks. We'll be right back. Thank you.
WJCT's Oddball podcast is getting national buzz, like this shout out on NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast.
What is making me happy this week is a new podcast that I discovered via NPR One. It is a podcast called Oddball.
That's Linda Holmes.
It's fun. It's entertaining.
Or maybe you use Apple Podcasts and saw Oddball featured first on the new and noteworthy list, or you saw it on Stitcher's What's Hot list. Check it out at oddballpodcast.com.
I was in my early 20s, and I'd been a total loser in school, but the world of musicians had welcomed me. It didn't matter what I looked like or what I sounded like. I could say the craziest, dumbest things at all. It didn't matter if I couldn't talk to girls, if I could talk to guitars. That was good enough.
This week, stories of feeling out of step with the world. That's The Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Saturday at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, the 6th annual Jax by Jax Literary Arts Festival is a celebration of authors with connections to this area. And this year, the organizers say there will be some big changes. Brad and Darlin Kuhn are here now with a preview. Hey, guys. Good morning.
Hey, thanks for having us on.
Good morning.
Okay, so this is coming up Saturday in downtown Jacksonville. And this has really grown over the years. Brad, let's start with you. What is Jax by Jax?
Jax by Jax is really, it's Jacksonville authors writing about Jacksonville, writers who were born in Jacksonville or have...
if they live here now. Mm-hmm. They use Jacksonville as their subject matter. Those are the three ways that they could get into the festival.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And this is coming up at both MoCA and the Downtown Library. And some changes this year. You're going to have some new attractions along with more than two dozen writers, the most diverse panel to date, it sounds like. Tell me about them.
Yes, we have... 15 writers who have been in the festival before, but we have 16 writers that are new to it. So we've got some new voices. We're very excited about that. It's pretty evenly matched, male and female, half and half, basically. And we are excited about the diversity of the panel, both of the writers as far as their ages, the genres that they write in, and all of the demographics. It's a wide range that really does represent all of Jacksonville.
And let's explain how this works, Brad. When people come out to the festival, they'll be listening to the writers read aloud from some of their works,
That's
right?
That's correct. We'll have writers on every 15 minutes, 15 minutes on, 15 minutes to sign, then the next one comes on. And in the past, we've paired writers up where you alternate back and forth and you typically go see one and then the other and you move on to another venue. Mm-hmm. This time you'll be able to sit in one venue or the other or move from venue to venue and you might hear 10 authors per room, which we're going to get a lot more cross-pollination, which is something the writers have asked us for.
The library is donating the space and some other services, which is great, along with some other groups. Women Writing for a Change will be at the event, too. What will they be doing?
Yes, Jen Wolf is going to lead a writing workshop, an interactive writing workshop. They are launching their new anthology. It's called A River Rising. And they're going to be having readers from that anthology lead small table workshops so people can come in and actually do some writing at the festival. And that's the first time we're doing that.
Now, you also have a student showcase, kids from Douglas Anderson, UNF, and FSCJ, and you're going to feature excerpts from local writers as part of a current exhibit at the library on poverty.
Yes, and you can go see that right now. On the second floor of the library, we have excerpts not only from writers that are appearing in Jax by Jax, but some of the writers who applied who had relevant content. And that's an amazing exhibit. I think Shawana Brooks put that together. And our library, the Jacksonville Library, just does a tremendous job of pointing out issues like that.
Yeah. And what I love about Jax by Jax is you're celebrating the printed word, but you're celebrating local talent.
Yes.
And how important is that?
Well, it's very important. I don't think that people know how many writers we have here. There are some very well-known people, but then there are folks who are... working on it every day and doing beautiful work, both student and professionals. And they're just out there, and we want you to get to know them. Mm-hmm. Come see your old favorites, but also hear the new voices.
That's a very important issue. People talk about how Jacksonville doesn't have culture, but we've lived here in town for a couple of years. Darlin grew up in Jacksonville and returned a couple of years ago.
Where'd you return from?
I had moved to Central Florida, to Orlando.
Okay.
But Jacksonville has so much going on, we're not able to keep up with it all. On any given night, we have to choose between five things to do. So it's really a false flag to say that Jacksonville has no culture.
And as I'm looking at the website, jacksbyjacks.com, you can learn about all of the writers at the festival on the website. Trisha Booker, Iman Byfield, Howard Denson, Wanda Duncan, Thomas Fariello, Carrie Foster. I'm reading just a few names. Sarab Homi Frassis, I'm probably mispronouncing that. Chris Gabbard, who's appeared on this program. Tim Gilmore, who was instrumental in founding the festival.
Absolutely.
Much loved local writer, and many more. And how about this? Thanks to the generosity of Chamblin's Bookstore next to the library, all of the writers are receiving an honorarium. And Chamblin's is stocking its shelves with all of the works of these writers. So if you hear a writer at Jacks by Jacks, you love the book and you want to get a copy, you just walk down the street to Chamblin's and you can buy a copy, right?
That's right. And that's something that's very important. Ron Chamblin actually is buying the books of these authors. It's not a consignment deal. He is buying and stocking both at the downtown location and at the Book Mine.
And folks can also decide ahead of time, if they know they like a writer's work, they can go into Chamblin's, buy it, and then have the writers sign it at the after party. Mocha is throwing a beautiful after party from 5 to 7 p.m. on Festival Day this Saturday, and the writers will all be there with their Sharpies ready to sign your books.
How exciting is that? And so not only is this celebrating the literary arts, you're celebrating downtown and trying to get people to come downtown on Saturday too,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely. It's a beautiful place to be. We're going to have a lot of fun. Hope everyone comes out.
Okay, so again, this is the 6th annual Jacks by Jacks Literary Arts Festival, a celebration of local authors, kicking off Saturday downtown at the downtown library at
10:30
a.m. Mm-hmm. We'll go all day, including into the evening with the after party at Museum of Contemporary Art. So mark your calendar for this Saturday. Come and support local authors because they are so talented. Go to jacksbyjacks.com for a full schedule and more information. And it's free.
Absolutely.
Yeah, just come on out to the library and be part of this. And thanks to the organizers, Brad and Darlin Kuhn. I know how much work it is to pull something like this together. So guys, thanks for stopping by and have fun this weekend.
Thank you, Melissa. And thank you for all you do.
We appreciate you.
A quick break. And in a moment, we have some other ideas for your weekend. New contributor Matt Pittman will join us and take us all around town. Lots happening this fall weekend, so don't go away. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be right back.
Grammy-winning violinist James Ennis has been called ferociously virtuosic. I'm Courtney Lewis. You'll hear that virtuosity when Ennis joins the symphony and me for Edward Elgar's beautiful violin concerto on November 15th and 16th. Tickets and more at jacksymphony.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Reese Witherspoon. She executive produced and stars with Jennifer Aniston in the new Apple TV Plus series, The Morning Show. It's about a network TV morning show in which the male anchor is fired after an accusation of sexual misconduct. Witherspoon has been outspoken about sexual harassment in the entertainment industry. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
The Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta covers much of the Southeast, and what happens there can be pretty representative of the American economy as a whole.
I've become more acutely aware of like the split in how people are experiencing the economy, and that's leading to splits in how we talk about what America is.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the president of the Atlanta Fed, next time on Marketplace.
Today at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
What happens when people go public with something the law says should be kept secret? Whistleblower protection laws date back to the 1770s. Can this old principle hold up against new technology? Transparency, secrecy, and holding the powerful to account. Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. The National Geographic Photo Ark uses the power of photography to inspire people to help save species at risk. Photo Ark founder Joel Sartori has photographed more than 9,000 species around the world, all to promote efforts to save them. Images from the Photo Ark are coming to the Jacksonville Zoo, and Sartori is appearing on the UNF campus this Sunday. I spoke with him.
We need to start paying attention to the world around us. We use these studio portraits of animals on black and white backgrounds to try to get attention to the fact that as the rest of the natural world fades away, we could too. So each of these animals is an opportunity to get people thinking about the world we live in, how we consume products, how we live our lives, and what we really need to do to try to save the other species that we evolved with. What most people don't think of, because our lives are busy and we're thinking about politics or sports or the price at the gas pump, what most people don't think about is that we have to have nature intact. We have to have clean air, clean water, and good, abundant food. And if we continue to despoil the planet with logging of rainforest, let's say, eventually we might disrupt the rainfall patterns that we need to bring us crops. These are big issues, but the change kind of starts at home. It starts with people buying the right products, not putting poisons on their lawn, insulating their homes. There are a million things you can do just with your consumer choice.
Good advice. So check it out as the Jacksonville Zoo and Gardens presents National Geographic Photo Ark founder Joel Sartori. He's appearing this Sunday night at 6 p.m. in the Lazara Performance Hall on the UNF campus. That's Sunday night. Finally, this hour, there are lots of options out there for your weekend. All right, Matt Pittman from Main Events Jax is kicking off a new Around Town segment for us right now, and we are so excited about it. Hey, Matt.
Hey, I'm excited to be here. Yeah.
It's so good to have you.
We've got a weekend packed full of events, whether it be sporting, music, you name it, and we'll kick it off with the sports as our Jacksonville Icemen are in Jacksonville. Actually, they have a game going on right now, but there's another game tomorrow night and on Saturday night. They're playing the Orlando Solar Bears. But what's cool about Saturday night is it's actually Marvel Hero Night. So if you want to dress up, you can do that. But they have a cool family four-pack deal. Costs you $80, but you get like a meet and greet with Spider-Man. You get some freebies. And then also, if you don't want to do the big little prize pack or parent pack, you can actually just buy four tickets for $20.
Okay, so that's the Iceman Saturday night at Veterans Arena.
That's
Friday
correct.
Night, Kevin James coming to town.
Kevin James, of course, we all know Kevin James from King of Queens. You know him from the movie Hitch. Maybe you know him from the movies Grown Ups. You can see him at the Florida Theater. FloridaTheater.com is where you can buy tickets. They start at $45. He actually just launched his Netflix special, came out earlier this year. So you can check that out as well, or go see him in person over at the Florida Theater.
Okay, let's go down to Mandarin. There's this big fall festival and chili cook-off thing happening.
What's cool about this? This is Mandarin Council's signature event each year. It's going on over at the River Place Shopping Center off San Jose Boulevard. Of course, going to be the Chili Cook-Off, but they've got arts and crafts. There's going to be beer and wine. It's a free event. It's fun. You can go to mandarincouncil.org for details.
And I got to make a plug for Wine and Trucks. This is Edible Magazine's Fall Festival at the Seawalk Pavilion on Saturday. I'm going to be moderating a talk there. This is the big thing for foodies.
Yeah, you love this. Feeding our edible Northeast Florida, I should say. They have amazing publication that, of course, specializes in food and wine and all that stuff. But this festival is going to be really cool. It's going on over at the Seawalk Pavilion. Your talk is going to be really cool because you actually get to talk to Man in Overalls, one of my favorite dudes from Springfield, Nathan.
Yes.
So that'll be really cool. But they'll have food trucks, like What's the Catch is going to be there. They'll have live music like the, what's it called? The Firewater Tent Revival is going to be performing. So.
All fun stuff. Now, speaking of Springfield, we have a really exciting ticket giveaway. We have one pair of tickets to the Jacksonville Hard Seltzer Fest at Sesquicentennial Park in Springfield. This is Saturday. Kicks off at 1 o'clock. So email us now if you want those tickets.
Are you into the hard water? The White Claws?
Right.
The Natural Light came out with their own. But yeah, you can check this out. This is going on again on Saturday from 1 to 7 p.m. Best way to find out, just go to Facebook, look up Jack's Hard Seltzer Fest.
Okay, and last but not least, the Jonas Brothers are coming to town Sunday night.
You a fan?
No. are you?
No, but you can go see them if you are. They're going to be performing over at the Veterans Memorial Arena. This is Sunday night at 7:30. Tickets start out at only $30. JacksEvents.com is where you can get all the details.
So many things happening this weekend. I mean, you had to go through a huge list just to cull it down to that short list, Matt.
If there's anything like Jacksonville right now, it's great that it's fall. You kind of feel that coolness going on. So all the festivals are coming, all the live music, whether it be Veterans Arena, Daily's Place. They're bringing some great acts here.
Thank you so much, Matt. He's Matt Pittman from Main Events Jax, taking us all around the town. We'll see you in a little bit. All right. And as we close the show, here's a little Jonas Brothers just for everyone to listen to. Thanks for being with us. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. Our news director at 89.9 is Jessica Palumbo, and Bill Bortsfield is digital editor. Keep those emails coming. Emails go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect. We'll be off tomorrow as NPR carries live coverage of ongoing impeachment hearings in Washington. But back Monday. See you then. And enjoy the music.
It's closing time, so leave with me again.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.